Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. This Saturday, November 9th, marks the 30th anniversary of the fall of the Berlin Wall. The wall itself was the physical and metaphorical separation of communism in the East and democracy in the West. And its fall symbolized the path forward for a united, democratic Germany. Today, we'll hear about the significance of that time through the lens of punk music. When you think of punk music, you probably imagine some mohawks, leather, maybe animal print, or the forever shirtless Iggy Pop, the gateway to some innocent teenage rebellion. But translator, music journalist, and former Berlin-based DJ Tim Moore argues that at least in 1980s East Berlin, the punk aesthetic was inherently political. Titled Burning Down the House, Punk Rock, Revolution, and the Fall of the Berlin Wall, the book charts punk's development from a music and fashion style to embodying the kind of freedom of expression that was denied in the GDR and which ultimately lay the groundwork for the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989, 30 years ago from tomorrow. I talked to Tim Moore about the book when it was released last year. Take a listen to our conversation. You first came to Berlin in 1992, and you admitted you showed up there kind of a stupid American. You thought it was Oktoberfest, and where's my beer?
Totally clueless. Yeah, I thought I'd get off the plane, and people would have those giant one-liter beers, and it would be a lot of lederhosen. And instead, I ended up in one of these typical high-rise East Block housing blocks, you know, with just 20 buildings that all look the same. And it was a surprise. And but fortunately, I pretty quickly found my way into the scene that was exploding at in the eastern part of the city. A lot of the central parts of East German cities had been pretty well destroyed during the war, and they tended to build up around the edges rather than refurbish the central parts. And so after the fall of the wall, the central parts became this kind of playground. They were setting up the first clubs and bars and galleries and all the things we associate with Berlin now. And I just landed in that world by coincidence, basically, and started DJing there.
And as you started to learn more, when did you have the inkling that there's a book here? There's a story to be told here.
Yeah, well, I mean, I grew up with the typical sort of Reagan America narrative about the end of the Cold War, that East German or East European kids wanted Levi's and hamburgers and pop music and all that, and Reagan had said tear down the wall, and the wall came magically down. But even though I was skeptical about that narrative, I didn't really have any concrete evidence to the contrary until I started to meet people in East Berlin who'd been involved in the political underground. And so all these clubs and bars and everything where I was hanging out, it turned out to be most of them had been founded by former members of the East German punk scene. And eventually, once I became friends with some of them, they showed me things like one guy had a folder he'd kept under a false drawer bottom during the dictatorship that had some lyric scraps and photos of him and his friends. And I realized, these are the people who actually fought the dictatorship. You know, a lot of them had gone to jail and been beaten and interrogated. And so I thought, this is a story I really want to tell at some stage.
Before we get into that, I do want people to get a sense of your writing. Would you mind reading a little bit from when you first got to Berlin?
Oh, sure, yeah. At first, the city seemed to fit the East Bloc stereotypes I'd grown up with in suburban America. It was the grayest place I'd ever seen, cloudy and cold, shrouded in coal smoke. Add to that the eerie sound of zoo animals howling in the distance and the constant fear sown by rumors of roving gangs of skinheads, and my initial impression of East Berlin was grim. But I quickly discovered a scene exploding with color and creativity behind the dilapidated, shrapnel-pocked facades of the central East Berlin boroughs of Mitte, Prenzlauer Berg, and Friedrichshain. Hidden behind unmarked doors, down ladders and empty lots, nestled among the crumbling bricks of a candlelit basement or a disused cistern, in the attics of half-destroyed buildings, even in abandoned bunkers and bank vaults, a kaleidoscopic new city was taking shape. The bars and clubs that made up this netherworld were dark and dirty, with extension cords meandering down from some distant outlet to power the sound system, and a couple of buckets of water behind the bar providing the only means to wash glasses. They were radically egalitarian, and they were open and welcoming to an outsider like me.
So as you began to research this, were people open? Did they want to tell you their stories?
Yeah, in some ways, I mean, I don't think the book would be possible if I didn't have a long history of some of the people from the scene, because I spent the 90s there in this world with them. But on the other hand, it became, I think, something of an advantage to be an outsider, at least partly an outsider, because there were a lot of people who spoke to me who'd never spoken on the record about their experiences before. There's a number of books in German, about the scene. They tend to be pretty insular things. It'll be someone who's part of the scene telling an oral history of the scene in Leipzig, say, or some other city in East Germany. No one had done a narrative history. And I think the fact that I didn't have a shared history with some of the people, particularly a lot of the important women in the story, hadn't spoken to the previous projects. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that once I had their trust and they were confident that my political motives were okay, that I wasn't trying to tell a typical American story, that on the contrary, I was actually trying to make a kind of corrective to the American narrative. Once I had that trust, then I think in some ways it was easier for people to talk to me.
Let's set the stage for folks. Before punk really got hold in East Berlin, it came through British radio. That's how most kids found it. What was life like for a young person, the average person in the GDR?
You know, I think one of the simplest ways to talk about the differences is how the punks saw it. They were sparked by Western radio. Most of them talk about the moment they heard the Sex Pistols on British military radio, for the most part. But it became something really Eastern, really fast. So where the British punks were talking about no future because they didn't see a place for themselves in society because of economic conditions, the punks, as they started to address the conditions in their own lives, they had the exact opposite problem, basically. Their lives were pre-scripted out. They had the communist youth organizations and military training in schools and an apprenticeship and then mandatory military service and then a job in the planned economy that they didn't necessarily have any interest in. So they talked about their problem as too much future. And they wanted to kind of wrest control of the big decisions in their own lives.
So the idea that where punk may have meant something in the United States about pushing back, rebelling against your parents, they were truly pushing back and rebelling against the political systems.
Yeah, although they certainly, most of them had trouble with the parents too. A lot of them ended up having to run away and sort of carving out space to live in these empty buildings. They became really good at carving out sort of physical and philosophical space to enact their ideology.
Was there any particular group or any particular song that became sort of the centerpiece of the movement?
There's a song after, the scene builds slowly from 1977 on. The first punk in East Berlin is generally acknowledged to be a 15-year-old girl who went by the name Major. And her first Stasi file was opened before she turned 16.
Explain to people Stasi.
Sorry, the secret police was the Stasi, and they started tailing Major from the time she was about 15 and a half. And eventually she became one of the first punks made an example of. In 1981, she was arrested, thrown in Stasi prison for a year. And then on top of that, she was given what they called the Berlin Verbot for 5 years. So she was shipped out to a town built around a textile mill and expected to work there in the middle of nowhere for the next 5 years, not see her family and friends. She ran away, went back to East Berlin, was rearrested, put back in Stasi prison for another year. And then at the end of that term, they expatriated her. So they shipped her off to West Germany just to take care of the problem. And then for the early 80s, there was a massive crackdown. Some of these bands ended up going to prison for up to 2 years because of their anti-government lyrics. And the hallmark of the scene really was that they would come back out after dealing with the police and the secret police and prison terms and keep fighting. That was the game changer, I think, for the scene. They were able to show, one of the big unknowns was what would happen to you if you ran afoul of the secret police. And they basically did the experiment. And they showed that it was possible to resist and survive. They went into jail, they came back out, they kept fighting. And one of the bands that went in and out of jail in 84, they came up with a song that had the lines, "We are the people, we are the power." And that became kind of an anthem inside the scene. And those lines were also then echoed in the street protests in 89 as the mass demonstrations started to snowball and into the scenes that we recognize from late in 89. So it's impossible to say for sure whether that song became the basis of this chant, but there's a pretty good chance. I mean, a lot of the punks were on the front lines of the early street protests because they were the ones who lost their fear of the security apparatus.
We're talking to Tim Moore about his book, Burning Down the House, H-A-U-S, Punk Rock, Revolution, and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. So, you know, somebody might be listening to this and thinking, why did the secret police, why did the Stasi think that kids and music and people dressed, expressing themselves, why is that dangerous? Why would they pay that much attention to them?
That was one of the biggest surprises for me as I started to do the research. You would see right from the start Stasi reports that were unbelievably paranoid about this scene. And I think it was basically, I mean, looking, well, as I got deeper into it, I realized that they were basically correct because they were fearful that the punk scene was pushing kids off this preordained script that they had for them. And it's true, they were. And they were really good at bringing kids to their side. I mean, a lot of it was started out pretty apolitical. It was just, it was fun, it was cool, it was daring, something people wanted to get involved in when they saw a punk walk down the street. But I think one of the powers of the scene was, unlike some of the other activist groups, or even activist artists who would put a visual piece of visual art or writing out into the world, they would sort of fade back into society as people. The punks expressed opposition every single time they appeared in public.
Because of their appearance,
because
right?
Of their appearance.
Wow. So in terms of what could happen to you, I mean, that's fairly brave. You figure you're going, you know you're going out, and you know because of your hairstyle or because of your clothing, you're a target.
I think it's almost impossible to conceive from a Western perspective what they were putting themselves through. Mm-hmm. What, I mean, the gravity of the situation they were getting into. Although, again, some of them didn't really realize. I guess we'll probably get to this at some point, but most of the concerts took place in churches.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Explain why.
Well, the church had a special status in East Germany. The uniformed security forces couldn't enter churches. So in theory, that meant they could offer a safe space and you could talk about taboo topics inside a church. It didn't always work out that way. In fact, one of these bands, a band called Namenlos, they were sent to prison for 2 years for lyrics of a song that Stasi never found on paper, but it had been overheard by an informant in a church concert. So it wasn't a perfect safe haven, but to an extent. But kids could go to one of these concerts and see a band and go, wow, this is cool, I want to get involved. And because the Eastern media also never recognized dissident activity, a kid could go and try to get involved with the scene, not realizing that the band they'd seen 2 weeks later was picked up and thrown in prison. So in a lot of cases, the kids were coming to it without a full understanding of what they were getting into.
How prevalent were informants?
It was really prevalent, and one of the striking things that they would recruit minors. So there's actually quite a lot of forgiveness within the scene for people who were informants because of the fact that they were so good at profiling people. They were really good at finding people who they could convince. Basically, if you work with us, you're keeping your friends out of prison. You're sparing them a detention or sparing them interrogation. And of course, they could do the opposite as well. If you didn't go along, they would say it would be a shame if your parents lost their jobs or your sister or brother got kicked out of school. So they were really effective at bringing in informants. But there's quite a lot of understanding among people because the Stasi was so good at their jobs. People who got paid for informing, that's a different story. They're still totally ostracized to this day. And actually, the only person who absolutely refused to speak to me for the book was a person who'd sent two of his bandmates to prison by informing.
Wow. So this is the research and the process question I have for you. If this was on the down low and people were, you know, not necessarily writing down lyrics or writing down where they're going to perform because of the fear of getting busted, even though they were, you know, they didn't have fear, but they didn't want, you know, people to be exposed, let's put it that way. How did you research this? How did you get all your information? I know you worked 10 years, but how did you write a narrative nonfiction book? How did you research it?
Well, I thought starting out that the most important resource would be the Stasi records themselves, which are really voluminous and they keep them open to researchers. But a lot of what they collected was pretty mundane. Somebody came out of the door at 8:05, went to the bakery at 8:07, bought two bread rolls, got on the subway at 8:17. You know, it wasn't the kind of material I needed to tell it in the kind of cinematic, fast-paced way I wanted to. So I ended up basically leaning on interviews. But of course, you can cross-check that against the Stasi records too. So the Stasi had great things. They had complete transcripts of interrogations. They would have massive reports on how they had smashed this or that concert or demonstration. But to get the personal aspects of the story, I talked about 50 people, the core people in the scene. And that formed the basis of why it sounds the way it does, the book.
And finally, before I let you go, you said that in an interview recently, this could be a handbook for resistance. How so?
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that the situation is a complete analog to other times and places, but they showed opposition-minded people a way forward. And I think one of the things that does translate really well is a phrase they used to spray paint up on walls in East Berlin, and it translated as, "Don't die in the waiting room of the future." And I think it's just a great rallying cry against complacency. You know, you can't sit around and hope change is going to happen. You have to go out and make it. And that was, I think that's really the core of what they were doing.
And that's a point you make in the book, that you see people doing that here in the United States.
Yeah, that was a scary aspect. The research took such a long time that it went from a story that was kind of interesting to me at a personal level to one that was almost eerily relevant. I'm looking at Stasi reports about the surveillance, for instance, and then Snowden comes along with the revelations about the level of mass surveillance here in the States, and I'm reading reports about how they smashed these concerts, and then I look up and you see the response to Black Lives Matter protests and the Dakota Pipeline protests, and yeah, it became, like I said, it was dishearteningly relevant. And then there's one thing that, I mean, it's tough to face, I guess, but people may not understand that, unlike our police, the East German cops couldn't just kill people in the streets.
Mm-hmm. And then on a happier note, Legs McNeil likes your book. And he wrote, Please Kill Me, and he wrote the book, Please Kill Me. What was that like for you when he said, yeah, it's a pretty good book?
Yeah, the thing for me was I've admired the people in this book for such a long time, ever since I first started to meet people from the scene back in the early 90s. And for them to be recognized by a figure like Legs, I mean, because obviously he's a legend to to them as well, that felt great to see the look on their, the few of them came over for the launch event, and to see the look on the face when Legs started talking about how important their story was and how courageous these people were, that was a really special moment.
Book's getting great reviews. Congratulations to you, Tim Moore. The name of it is Burning Down the House, Punk Rock Revolution and the Fall of the Berlin Wall. Thanks for joining us on all of it.
Thank you very much.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging in an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.